HPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For the past 5 years, the city of Franklin has tried to restrict where a certain group of people can live, registered sex offenders. In 2007, Franklin and a handful of other New Hampshire communities passed laws specifying how close these offenders can reside near places where children might congregate, schools, parks, daycare centers, and so forth. But earlier this year, a Superior Court judge struck down Franklin's law, saying the city failed to show how these rules safeguard children and that the law violated equal protection rights. Now, though, Franklin is appealing, filing papers recently with the state Supreme Court. City leaders say the judge overreached and that common sense dictates that limiting proximity to children decreases the likelihood kids will be harmed. Franklin's statute and others like it came as part of a national effort to crack down on sex offenders that began 2 decades ago. In fact, New Hampshire passed laws in the mid-2000s that some called among the toughest in the country. But now some others are questioning whether these measures really work. Emerging research indicates that marginalizing those who've committed sex crimes may actually make them more likely to reoffend. That argument's a tough sell to the public, however, especially given skepticism that these particular types of criminals are even capable of rehabilitation. Today in The Exchange, we examine the Get Tough on Sex Offenders policies that New Hampshire has adopted over the years and whether they work. Let's hear from you. Do you see sex offender registries or limits on where they can live better protecting the public? Is there another side to these policies that we're not thinking about? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. With us in studio is Tom Reed, Deputy County Attorney for Rockingham County. And Tom, good to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome.
Also with us, Chris Dornan, founder of Citizens for Criminal Justice Reform, a nonprofit working for what it calls restorative justice. He's also a longtime prison volunteer. And Chris Dornan, good to meet you. Thank you for being here
Good to be here, Lauren.
Well, and Chris, before we get into all the policies and how we feel about them today, why did you get into this work defending people who many people feel are indefensible?
It's not all I do. Our program works for all people on parole and in prison and their loved ones. But the group of sex offenders is under heavy attack right now. So we are focusing on that. But how I got into it, I was a State House reporter for 10 years listening to watching our crime laws get made. And the way we were making particularly sex offenders laws made no sense to me. I look at research. I'm driven by facts. And misinformation and fear and anger were driving the legislation. I was also a volunteer at the state prison as a ministry. A woman who joined our board of directors when we founded it matched me up with a sex offender. And I saw the world through his eyes. It's full of catch-22s. I understood how the sex offender treatment program works and what sex offenders go through in prison and what it's like for them on the outside. And when I retired from journalism, I wanted to find the most important, hardest thing I could do, and this was it.
Well, defending sex offenders is hard work. I think nobody's going to argue with that.
Yeah, you have a point.
When you say, that our sex offender laws are based on fear, rage, gut reactions, not the facts. Those who write these laws, as you well know, Chris, say, hey, we are doing our best to protect the public, especially kids who can be literally scarred for life by a sex offense. And we all know people who have been scarred for life by a sexual crime. So what are you trying to say there, that this is really just about fear and rage?
The intent is certainly safety. I will give people that credit. And I wish they were going about it better. Typical sex offender law in Florida, Jessica Lunsford was kidnapped, raped, and buried alive. And lawmakers, and there was another heinous crime against a child in the same month, February of 2005. And lawmakers had, it took them 1 month to approve a draconian sex offender, a child predator law It passed 100 with no opposition, and Governor George and Governor
for light speed legislation. Yeah,
Jeb Bush signed it into law about 3 months after the crime, and within a year, 16 states had copied that law, including New Hampshire. Kelly Ayotte introduced the legislation the summer after the spring when Florida passed its law.
Well, and I remember in the mid-2000s doing lots of shows on Governor Lynch's efforts to toughen up New Hampshire's sex offender laws. So what are you saying then, though, by this quickness? Are we doing a poor job? Are we not achieving any goals of public safety? Or what are you trying to say by that example?
Speed is very dangerous when you're messing with civil liberties, messing with the Constitution, and trying to make the world safer. If you do it in anger and with a spirit of vengeance, you're liable to overdo it and create unintended consequences.
And we'll definitely talk about some of those.
And we have.
And Tom Reed, I want to bring you into this. I mean, and we'll get into the specifics in a minute, but what do you think? You know, do we just jump on this bandwagon too fast? We're overreacting. We're not looking at research. We're just, you know, working out of anger and fear.
Well, I certainly don't think we're just working out of anger and fear. When we are talking about individuals who have been convicted of sex crimes, any crimes, there are certain goals of sentencing, which include deterring that individual from committing it again, general deterrence, making sure there are protections in place and possible sanctions that people who might commit these crimes are aware of, which might even include the fact that they could go to prison, the fact that they might have to register as sex offenders when they get out. And those things that are known to individuals operate to deter generally people from committing these crimes. We also have a component of punishment, certainly, for the conduct that harmed a victim and so horribly harmed child victims in some cases, as well as a component of rehabilitation. And we have to recognize that for offenders who aren't the three-strike sex offenders who are going to be incarcerated for the rest of their lives, at some point they're going to get out. And when they're out, we have an obligation to make sure that there has been treatment and other protections in place that, one, that they're rehabilitated to the extent that we can, but recognizing the possibility and sometimes likelihood of them reoffending, that we make sure there are protections in place that will minimize the risk of their reoffending. And I think we have an obligation to do that, certainly with people that we know that their constitutional protections have been in place, that they've been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt of committing a sex crime in the first place. Then once we know that, if we put them back into our community, we better make sure, and we have an obligation to make sure that they're not going to harm somebody else's child.
Here's the question, though, Tom. If I rob a convenience store, let's say I serve, you know, 5 years in prison or whatever, and then I'm out, I'm done. But if I commit a sex offense, when I'm out, I'm not done, right? I'm on a registry. Might not be able to live wherever I want. It seems like once people do their time for a sex crime, they're kind of marked for life.
Well,
and what's the thinking behind that?
I think, you know, every felon is marked for life to the extent that they can't possess a firearm. There are certain restrictions for certain types of offenses. Those who commit sex offenses, there are statutes that prohibit them from being involved in child care services. There are a whole number of things and restrictions that come with, you know, you being held accountable for a crime which you've been proven to have committed beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, we look at cases of domestic violence and you try and figure out which case is going to be the case that escalates to that level where somebody actually gets killed. You don't know. You can't look at every case and brand the person and say this is someone who's going to kill somebody. But we know through a study and through so many cases that have happened, what are red flags to look for? You know, certain things, that conduct that has escalated, that when it reaches a certain level, you see certain things, and strangulation is one of them. That's known as a red flag, that if you see that in a particular case, this is more than just a fight. There's a history here, and this is a case that you need to do a little more. With sex offenders and what we know about sex offenders, you know, we do know there's a recidivism rate. What we know about sex offenders that's different than the person who robs a convenience store, and the convenience store that can put up monitors and take steps to protect themselves from getting robbed again. What we do know about sex offenders is a very sad truth and reality, that there is a high recidivism rate. And more importantly, sex crimes are the most underreported crime in this country. And so when we're looking at recidivism rates of sex offenders, those are the crimes for which they're convicted of again. But I would submit to you there is information of a lot of unreported sex offenses from these people who have previously been convicted, and that's unacceptable. We need to do what we can to make sure that those children aren't victimized. And I think we need to make sure that parents are aware of the red flags. And that's part of letting people know and giving people the ability to find out, is the person who wants to volunteer to be my kid's baseball coach, soccer coach, daycare provider, you know, do they have this kind of record? And they're either Googling it and finding out that, oh, here I see a newspaper article where they were convicted one day, or they're getting the information through some kind of registry.
And that's what we have now, registries around the country, right, in every state.
And there are some differences in the types of registries and what types of offenses have to be put in the and how much information is put on the registry. And I think that certainly the debate is appropriate to have right now in terms of how much information is on the registry. Should we be looking more specifically at individual offenses? Should there be a mechanism for certain individuals to have some type of panel decide that they can come off the registry? And let's really identify the most dangerous individuals and put them on the registry and provide more information on them. And we do need to do a better job of limiting the number of people that are on the registry, because otherwise the registry is not providing useful information.
Well, and let's talk about that just a little bit more. And for starters, Chris Dornan, just remind us about this registry movement that sprung up in the 90s, late 90s,
sure,
when Congress said, yeah, we can have a national sex offender registry law. Just how much was that a game changer, first of all?
It was huge. The first registry was in response to the kidnapping and disappearance of Jacob Wetterling out in Minnesota. The lawmakers asked his mother, Patty Wetterling, who was a child advocate, what kind of law might have prevented the abduction. There was a group home for sex offenders nearby, and she thought maybe if the police had known, if you had a registry of the people, it would have solved the crime. She has been opposed to public registries, and she's been opposed to our sex offender laws in general ever since.
So she favored the police having the access to the information, but not the general public.
Correct.
All right. More on the registries coming up. And also we'll take a closer look at efforts to restrict where sex offenders can live. We'll go to the city of Franklin for that. Our number for you to join us with your questions and comments, personal experiences, is 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Capital Well Clean Water Center, helping families drink pure, safe water since 1986. Capital Well Clean Water Center, serving all of New Hampshire. Details at capitalwell.com. From Wilson Employment Network, successfully impacting their clients' productivity by recruiting qualified talent for New Hampshire employers for over 12 years. Online at wilsonemployment.com. And UNH Manchester, the university's urban campus, celebrating the achievements of the class of 2012. Manchester.unh.edu. More on dealing with sex offenders on the exchange on NHPR and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, John Edwards' criminal case, and campaign finance laws. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny. High temperatures near 60 in northern areas of the state, ranging to around 70 in southern New Hampshire. Tonight, clear and cool. Lows near 30 in the North Country, ranging to 40 in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking again at policies toward sex offenders in New Hampshire and whether they work to both rehabilitate criminals and protect the public. We invite you to join us with your questions and comments on this at 1-800-892-6477. Do some of these policies, like sex offender registries open to the public or certain limits on where they can live, protect people better from sex offenders? Is there another aspect to these policies that we're not thinking about? Some of the problems that our guest Chris Dornan raises. Join us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And before we go to the phones, Tom Rita, did want to get your thoughts, too, on just this movement that we saw, you know, 15, 20 years ago for these sex offender registries and how much of a game changer these were.
Well, I want to correct. I think that Wetterling created registries in general, and then Megan's Law is what moved certain things to the public list.
So at first they were only open to law enforcement.
Correct. And in New Hampshire still, there's only a certain class of offenders who are on the public list, and it's those offenders against children and those offenders who are repeat offenders. And that's expanded, of course, through the Adam Walsh Act. But I don't know how much of it, you know, you would call it a game changer. I think, you know, the jury is still out on the evidence of whether or not this has provided protection for people. I think it has provided peace of mind for parents. You know, as I indicated before, there's a statute which prohibits sex offenders from engaging in certain types of work. But, you know, I think it's more important to allow parents to, and people who are going to employ individuals in these sensitive positions, to have a mechanism to find out if the individual that they want to hire has this kind of history, if the red flag is there. Because sitting back and waiting for the sex offender to simply obey the law and say, I'm not going to take that job because I know it would be a crime, that's not going to happen. And there's small solace for a parent when the person in child care services or the coach harms their child to then say, but we can also charge you with having violated the prohibition from child care services. So to some degree, I would call it a game changer in that it allows us to find out and parents to find out and make important decisions for the safety of their children.
Do these registries, Tom, distinguish between types of sex offenses? For example, the 19-year-old who has sex with his 16-year-old girlfriend versus, you know, a repeat pedophile?
Well, it depends on the state and what types of offenses are required to register and for how long. And there are different states. In Rhode Island and Massachusetts, they evaluate the offender based on their conduct, not their convictions. They look at likelihood to reoffend. Here in New Hampshire, we look at the type of offense, and then there's three different tiers for registration. And then, as I said, whether or not they're on the public list is based on the age of the victim or whether or not they have priors. The vast majority of our sex offenders are offenders against children, however.
Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. A tough topic today in the exchange. We're looking at our emerging policies towards sex offenders, how they've toughened up over the years, and whether those policies actually work to protect the public, to rehabilitate criminals. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And joining us first from Concord is John. Hi, John. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. How are you today?
Fine.
I called because of the fact that the Franklin incident, we had a bill in the legislature several years ago to do that statewide. And based upon the information we had, for example, Springfield, Massachusetts was looking at doing that. And when they looked at all the restricted areas they would have, they found out that the only place in Springfield that the sex offender could live is in a one-square-block area of a warehouse district, which would have made it impossible for them to live in the town, in the city of Springfield. And information showed us that from out west in the Midwest, there was a state that did that. And when they passed that law, they lost approximately 40% of their registered sex offenders. They just stopped registering, not stopped moving into areas where they shouldn't, were prohibited to be.
So they kind of went underground, John.
That's correct.
Right.
And we felt that it was more important to know where they are than to tell them they couldn't live somewhere where they probably lived there anyway.
So you've looked at this as a state lawmaker and concluded that residency requirements, such as we see in Franklin and a couple other towns, Tilton comes to mind, don't work, John? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. I've been involved in this issue since the first predator bill. I was actually on the conference committee between the House and the Senate on that bill. So I've had some experience dealing with the issue.
Wow. All right. Well, John, thanks a lot for calling in. And to you, Chris Dorn, I think first, you know, the residency requirements drive sex offenders underground. People decide, I'm just not going to register if I'm going to be restricted on where I live.
Absolutely. John Thole was talking about Iowa. It was 42% of the people stopped registering there. And the attorneys and the police and social worker groups in Iowa strongly opposed the residency restrictions because they were endangering safety, not to mention doing tremendous harm. What the residency restrictions do is zone somebody out of their home. It tends to make people homeless. You can sign them to a place where there is no available housing. It's hard for them to get housing to begin with. They have loved ones that may get tired of being jerked around from place to place to place, being driven out. So the sex offender loses his support. Those kind of collateral damages to the person tend to destabilize them.
How do you feel, Chris, about the argument, though? And I'm listening to you,
yes.
And I'm thinking, okay, you know, in theory, I hear what he's saying, but I've got two children. You know, you say
yeah.
sex offenders lose their support, and I think, well, too bad for them, right? I mean,
yeah.
you know, what about victim rights or potential victim rights balanced with those sex offender
sure.
rights that you talked about?
That's a common sense response. The Minnesota Sex Offender Management Board decided to find out if residency restrictions protect the public or not. They examined 224 sex crimes by repeat offenders and looked at the modus of operandi, how they hooked up with the person and groomed them, and came to the conclusion that residency restrictions wouldn't have prevented any of those crimes. In California, they have a draconian sex offender restriction that spiked the homelessness rate 800% among sex offenders in the first year.
So if they're homeless, you can't keep track of them at all.
Plus, they're destabilized and more likely to reoffend.
What do you think about that, Tom?
Well, when I listed the goals of sentencing, I pointed out that we do have to work towards rehabilitation. And having them, you know, any offender who's now out in the community in a stable environment, a stable residence, some support structure from family, friends, whatever it might be, a job, and access to counseling and treatment. And people around them that when they start, you know, starting to go off track, do something, let someone know, and get them more services. And so we absolutely need to try to do that. And so that is something to look at in terms of looking at the residency requirements. Unfortunately, I very often hear the argument against the residency restrictions being that it will force them to not register. And the idea that, you know, there are certain sex offenders who will choose to ignore the law or ignore their the requirements that have been placed on them, you know, those may be the sex offenders we need to be concerned about.
So are you saying, even though you and Chris often approach this issue from different perspectives, you agree with him on this, that these residency restrictions are not a good idea?
I think you need to look at the individual residency restriction. As I said, I'm not sure that it's clear. Clearly, the experiment in Iowa, the problem with there being so few places for them to live, that's a problem. And as I said, I certainly agree with Chris that we need to, and I think everyone agrees, we need to do what we can to make sure the supports are in place because the people are going to be in the community. And making sure that they have the supports, the structure, you know, that's going to help prevent them from reoffending. That's going to protect the public. So I certainly agree with that.
All right. Well, joining us now on the phone is Ken Merrifield, and he's been looking at this issue a lot, as you both know. He's the mayor of the city of Franklin, which is in the midst of a court battle over residency restrictions for sex offenders. And Mayor Merrifield, we always appreciate you making the time for us. Thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure, Laura. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, just real briefly, what exactly does your law say about where sex offenders can and can't live after they get out of prison?
Okay. Well, the property that is restricted and restricted for 2,500 feet from the property line includes a school or a daycare, playgrounds, municipal ski area, and the Winnipesaukee River Trail.
And what if a sex offender, Mayor Merrifield, got into trouble with adults, not kids? The places you mentioned are where kids might congregate.
I'm sorry if they got in trouble.
Yeah, what
and
if they're...
they offend and break the law, they'd be treated like anyone else.
No, I guess my point is if someone's a registered sex offender for an adult offense, child offense, do they still have to stay away from kids?
These restrictions are aimed particularly at those people who must register for life because of offenses against children.
Got it. Okay. And regarding the court cases, Mayor Merrifield, and you've been quoted a lot on this, including saying, look, this law is based on common sense. What do you mean there?
Well, I guess what we're saying, what the city council's position, and I think I can articulate the council's majority, if not unanimous, position on this, is that we believe that when you have a type of offender who has been demonstrated to have a four times the recidivism rate of other types of offenses, that proximity and access can promote that recidivism. And so we feel that this is a method, and certainly not foolproof, but a method of restricting access and proximity.
an access and proximity that provide too much of a temptation, Mayor Merrifield.
Exactly.
How do you feel about some of the research that we were just talking about from other states that have looked at this, indicating that these laws might not work, that when you marginalize people, you prevent them from that family and community support that will help them rehabilitate, will help them get on the right path? How do you feel about that, Mayor Merrifield?
I'm curious if we do the same sort of research on DWI laws. We do the same sort of research on burglary and homicide law. And clearly, those laws are not effective, right? Because we still have all of those crimes. And I don't see anyone proposing that we eliminate those statutes.
I think it's more about how you treat people once they get out. They're trying to reintegrate into the community, and at least if they're from Franklin, it's tough.
Well, certainly, but there are places in Franklin that are available to people with this history. With affordable housing, they can certainly find a location in Franklin to live.
So there are places in Franklin where they can live.
There are. I mean, there are restrictions. And something that we may look at, too, as a result of the recent court case, we may look at reducing the distance barrier that we've set up of 2,500 feet to make more of the city available.
I see what you're saying. So opening up a little more property.
Right.
How do you feel about the court cases that have gone through on this, especially the fact that you just got rejected a couple months ago by the Superior Court? What do you think the judge was thinking there?
Well, the argument seemed to be that because we were taking a substantial and important right, constitutional right, away from someone, that we had to provide more compelling evidence. And the thing that troubles me about this is that the judge in this case seemed to be substituting his own judgment for how much evidence was required. And I guess going back to the earlier comment that I made, I think that the Franklin City Council believed at the time that this measure is really the result of common sense, and we think it is self-evident that if you remove proximity and you remove access, you stand a better chance of preventing recidivism.
One last question for you, if I could, Mary Merrifield. Where is this case now in terms of court action? I read you've appealed to the state Supreme Court. Is that right?
We filed an appeal. I am not sure whether we will pursue that all the way or if we will choose another legislative option. We are looking at a number of different ways to approach the court decision.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time for us this morning. Thank you.
My pleasure.
That's Ken Merrifield again, mayor of the city of Franklin, which has gotten into trouble in court and is going back to court perhaps over its residency restriction for sex offenders. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your thoughts about these policies towards sex offenders that have been on the books for a while now. We're looking at how effective they have been. Some of the new questions about these policies. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. And Jane's calling in from Amherst, gentlemen. And hi, Jane, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I wondered if you could share some information about the number of offenses against children that occur from within families or close family members. I mean, this is a situation where proximity and access is not going to be limited by a residency requirement.
Oh, Jane, this is such an important point. Thank you so much for raising it. And both of you gentlemen, Chris, to you first. From what I understand, most of the sex offenders are within family members, friends of the family, and so forth, making it hard to report, hard to track, hard to stop.
Well, you're absolutely right. Something like 90% of the offenses against children are by somebody they love or should trust. 19 out of 20 offenses against children are going to be by somebody who's not on the registry at all and not subject to residency restrictions. The mean stranger watching the playground, that myth simply doesn't pertain. That's not who we have to worry about. And the registry gives folks, victim advocates are saying this all across the country, that the registry promotes a false sense of security. You don't realize that the threat may be from within your own family.
So our policies are based on this stranger danger myth, but that's not the reality.
That's correct. The heinous cases that get all the headlines are the stranger danger because they're so rare and shocking.
Yeah. Can you address that too, Tom? I've heard other people make that criticism that, you know, really a lot of this is among people kids know and love in some cases and should be able to trust.
Well, let me look at some figures I have here because I heard Chris's figures and I'm not sure where those come from. Looking at a Bureau of Justice statistics survey shows that 70% of all men in prison for a sex crime were men whose victim was a child. And then it was estimated that almost half of the child victim cases, the child was the prisoner's own son or daughter or other relative. That's not quite as high as Chris said, but still pretty high. It's a lot. But half. So one of the tragedies in families is that, again, it's very often not reported. Even when a child does report it, other family members don't believe it. They love the offender. And we've seen cases where an offender against children is released from prison, brought into a family member's home. They're trying to help provide the support and so forth. And a minute away from the child, they find out, walk into the room, and the child's being molested or assaulted or abused by the relative who everyone knew and was on notice that they'd done this before. Then talking to the child, it's discovered that this has been going on for a while. And I'm thinking of a specific case, yeah. Obviously.
Well, it's a familiar story. But yeah. How does a registry help with that, or a residency requirement like Franklin's help with that?
Well, it may not. As I said, that's of the 70% of the offenders in prison who were offenders against children, about half are those who are probably relatives. And they may still not be in the same family. It isn't necessarily going to help that. It's going to help the other half, perhaps, and it's going to help protect people from the recidivist. The registry laws aren't going to protect people from the first-time sex offender. And the first-time sex offender generally, you know, first conviction, rather, there's the numbers show and the studies show they've had a lot of victims before they get caught. It's not going to protect people from that. It's the people that we know about that we've now, you know, the red flag is up. We've convicted them once. If it's going to protect people from them, we need to do what we can. Because people ask, you know, to those people who try and help an offender, what were you thinking when you had him in your house? Because people think that way. If someone has done that before, they might do it again, and I'm going to make sure I protect my child from them.
All right. Lots more to talk about after a short break. And we'll keep taking your calls, so stay on the line and stay with us.
For the past 9 months, we've been exploring New Hampshire's immigration story. Next week, we wrap up our coverage with a series of special shows on the exchange, including a Socrates exchange pondering, who is an American? There'll be reports from the newsroom, and we'll cap it all off with an hour-long documentary chronicling the last 200 years of New Hampshire's immigration story. Tune in next week and visit nhpr.org for more information. Made possible in part by the Norwin S. and Elizabeth N. Bean Foundation. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from AARP, presenting You've Earned a Say, a community discussion on Medicare and Social Security, inviting Granite Staters to join the conversation. Questionnaire at aarp.org/NH. And Louis Carno and Company, Public Relations, supporting the Squam Lakes Chamber, who celebrate the original Golden Pond where the loons still call. Information at visitsquam.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, dealing with sex offenders. We'll look at this long debate here in the Granite State. Some say we've got some pretty tough laws on the books here in New Hampshire, including a handful of cities and towns which restrict where sex offenders can live. But some others are now questioning whether these policies work, whether marginalizing offenders after they've done their time behind bars makes rehabilitation, reintegration more difficult. We'd love your thoughts on this topic, your personal experiences, your questions, your opinions. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Chris Dornan and Tom Reed, let's go back to our callers. Jill joins us on the phone. Hi, Jill. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. I just wanted to clarify something. We do not have anybody on our registry, 17-year-old, who has sex with a 16-year-old. In New Hampshire, our age of consent is 16. And if somebody who's under 16, let's say a 15-year-old, is having sex with a 17-year-old boyfriend, that would be considered a sexual assault. However, that person would not be on the registry. Our statutory rape crimes are not on the registry. For sexual penetration, the age difference has to be more than 4 years. And for sexual contact, it has to be more than 5 years.
Jill, I'm just quick. I really want to clarify, and I appreciate you calling in. So let's say there's a 20-year-old or 19-year-old who has sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend. Is he now on the registry?
If there's more than 4 years age difference, yes. So if you, and again, when you're talking about 19 and 20, they're out of high school.
Right.
It's been shown that they're peer pressure. There's more when it's an older person that's not in the peer group. So if you have an 18-year-old having sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend, you know, a senior and a freshman or sophomore, that is a crime. And it would, if it went through the system, it would be a sexual assault. But that 18-year-old would not have to register.
And what about, though, the 20-year-old and the 15-year-old, just to say, that 20-year-old would be on the registry.
Yes.
What if they're in a relationship? Should this person really be counted as a sex offender and be sort of tagged for life for that?
Well, I think you have to ask yourself, why is a 20-year-old going to a high school age student for a date? You know, there's a different peer group there once you're out of school. And the way psychologists and psychiatrists look at it is a 15-year-old is much more vulnerable to pressure and manipulation by somebody that is not in their peer group. And a 20-year-old is not considered in a 15-year-old's peer group.
The broader issue we've been looking at, Jill, and I'm glad you called because you clearly know a lot about this, is the policies that we've been following here in New Hampshire for at least the last, 5 to 10 years, the registry requirements, the residency restrictions that some towns have passed. Just real broadly, Jill, what do you think? Do these policies work to better protect the public, to properly punish sex offenders?
Well, I think, again, it would not be a punishment per se, but I think a lot of people, when they look at the registry, you know, think that we do have people on the registry who committed a statutory rape. We don't. We have people think that we have people who commit indecent exposure and lewdness on the registry. So if somebody flashes a school bus, that person would not be required to register. In order to be on the registry for an indecent exposure and lewdness, somebody has to commit a sex act on themselves or another in the presence of a child under 16. Okay. They actually have to commit a sex act. So when we have the public looking at our registry and thinking, a flasher is on there, they're not. So I think there's a lot of misconceptions about the people that are on the registry.
Okay.
They commit more heinous crimes than some people realize. As far as statewide residency restrictions, we did look at that a few years ago, and there was a lot of research that indicated Iowa was the first state to pass the law, I believe in 2004, and within 1 year, they went from having 100 non-compliant offenders to 400, which was a 350% increase.
Right. And Jill, I think we did cover that a little bit earlier, so I'm going to cut you off in the interest of time, but thank you very much for the comments on the registry. I really appreciate it. All right. Bye-bye. So just very broadly, Chris Dorn and Jill saying, look, you know, if you're on that registry, it's not just because you made one bad mistake. You have made a lot of mistakes or you've done something really bad.
There have been a lot of research on whether the tiers of the Adam Walsh Act correlate with risk at all, and they don't. There's several reasons for it. Somebody who's committed 3 sex crimes against one individual shows up as a lifetime registrant, and somebody who's very dangerous and pleads down to a lesser offense might show up as a tier one, but they're incredibly dangerous. There was no correlation. As an example, Ohio used to evaluate all of its sex offenders and assign them to tiers after a judicial process and clinical evaluations. Doing it that way, they had 18% of the people were deemed a substantial risk and 78% were not.
So the list got a lot shorter.
Then they went to Adam Walsh to comply with Adam Walsh and not lose their federal money.
That's a law. Federal law.
And the high risk rate went from 18% to 80.
So it's all a question of judgment? Is that what you're saying?
There's no judgment in it. That's what I'm saying. The Adam Walsh tiers are arbitrary. They don't correlate with risk.
Well, isn't risk subjective? How much of a risk a particular person
poses?
No,
there's a great deal of research. Carl Hansen, a Canadian criminologist, has pioneered any number of ways of coming up with actuarial risks for certain factors. Age is obviously one of them. The older you are, the less sex drive, and that's one factor that correlates with low risk.
Could I ask you also, Tom Reed, your quick thoughts on Jill's points, and clearly she knows the list in and out, that if you're on there, you really did do some bad things. It's not just any random person who made one mistake.
Well,
Sergeant How effective Rocky, do you think this list is?
Jill is Sergeant Rocky from State Police. I'm certainly familiar with her. She worked on the registry and has been in the forefront working on some of the legislation here. And her point should be well taken, that there is misinformation. People want to say, hey, every flasher, every statutory rape is on there, and these are people who are in love and so forth. And so I agree with her assessment. I wouldn't say that we can sit here and say that everybody on the list is certainly as dangerous as someone else on the list. And that's why some of these other states that look at the conduct itself and look at a few more things and have mechanisms to identify, you know, how dangerous someone is, that's something we should explore. Absolutely. Because if the list is too large, it's not going to be helpful, and it can be harmful to some of the lower risk folks. But in listening to what she said, we should all remember that there are cases where people plea down to lesser offenses, and there are cases that involve sex offenders who, you know, one of the hallmarks of a sex offender is not particularly honest, manipulate their victims. They also manipulate their loved ones. And we very often hear people tell stories of, you know, how their innocent relative was convicted of a crime, but all they did was, you know, fall in love with a young girl. And when you look at the case, it's usually something very different and sometimes very egregious. So, you know, we do need to look at the individual conduct in these cases as well.
Well, joining us now on the phone is another individual who's been actively involved in these policies. With us is Barbara Keshen, lawyer for the New Hampshire American Civil Liberties Union, which has been actively opposing the residency restrictions that we talked about earlier on where sex offenders can and can't live in a community. Barbara, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, we heard earlier from Mayor Merrifield in Franklin, who, as you know, is a strong supporter of that city's residency requirement. And he said, look, you know, city leaders are unanimous on this. These offenders are very likely to reoffend. And this is a method of protecting kids, not the only method, but a method. What do you think?
Well, to look at the legal context that this case has come about in, you start with the idea that everyone in this state has an important substantive right, and that is to live where they want to live. And the government can take away that right, but only if they can show that by taking away that right, they will be able to affect an important government interest. And what we have argued is that there is no evidence at all that restricting where sex offenders live actually keep children safe for all the reasons that your guests have already discussed.
Don't keep kids safe. Why not, Barbara?
They don't keep them safe because, first of all, kids are kept safe when the people that they live with don't molest them, and 95% of kids are molested by people that they know. What these laws, what the law of the city of Franklin tries to do is what I say, legislate against airplane crash. Very few children, thankfully, are abducted by strangers. There are over 60,000 arrests every single year on child sexual assault, and less than 0.25% involve child abductions, which is what the city of Franklin is trying to protect against. But what the law does instead is to have the counterproductive effect of making children less safe because they cluster where sex offenders live, They drive them underground if they can't register in their own homes. They prevent probation officers and parole officers from knowing where they are. And they keep them from getting counseling, which has been very effective for sex offenders. And it really makes sex offenders difficult to reintegrate back into society.
Well, and Barbara,
and when they can't reintegrate back into society, they're not stable.
One last question for you, if I could. Mayor Merrifield said they're looking at possibly, first of all, he said there are places where sex offenders can live in Franklin, that the whole town hasn't been cordoned off, so to speak, but he said they might possibly consider reducing that distance barrier, 2,500 feet now around any school or playground and so forth. They might consider reducing that distance to open up more of the town to these folks. What do you think? Does that make you feel better about this law?
I think that becomes a matter of fact. You know, how much affordable housing would be available in the town of Franklin? And if there's no affordable housing available in the town of Franklin, doesn't that make the surrounding communities absorb the population that, you know, that Franklin would otherwise absorb? And is that fair?
All right, Barbara, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Barbara Keshen, lawyer for the New Hampshire American Civil Liberties Union. And Tom Reed, Chris Dornan, I'd like to get one more call in if we could. This is Bob in Nottingham. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I just have one question. With the high rate of recidivism that the gentleman there mentioned a while back, I'd be interested to hear what your guests have to comment about what is missing from our rehab program, and I'll listen off air.
Bob, that is a million-dollar question. Thank you so much for calling in. Gentlemen, let's try and tackle this in the few minutes we have left. Chris Dornan, first of all, the high rate of recidivism, there's a lot of disagreement about how high it is, so just briefly address that.
I've been chafing at the bit to contest that. The highest credible study has it at about 24% after 15 years by Carl Hansen. I've interviewed him about that, and he said a lot of the studies in the meta-analysis go back to the 1960s, 70s, and 80s when a completely different kind of inmate went in for a sex offense.
And probably our data collection wasn't as good either.
Yeah. State by state, recidivism rates over 3 years. Iowa, 4.3%. 5.3% after 3 years in a 15-state federal study. 3% after 3 years in Alaska, 4.7% after 3 years in Tennessee.
That's really low. Those aren't the numbers we usually
hear. 1.05% in Indiana, 3.8% after 3 years in Delaware, 2.4% after 3 years in Illinois.
So, Chris, why do we so often hear that these people are, you know, unable to be rehabilitated? There's a 60, 70, 80, 90% chance that they will do these crimes again.
Kelly Ayotte, when she was attorney general, told lawmakers that the recidivism rate was between 90 and 94%, based on a Canadian study by Ron Langevin, which was castigated in a whole issue of the Canadian Journal of Criminology was devoted to it as unethical and unscientific.
I have to ask you this too, Tom Reed, and super quick on the numbers, but I love Bob's broader question. What's missing?
Money. I mean, number one, money. The recidivism rates, you know, I've got a ring binder here full of studies as well, and the rates are much higher. And as I indicated before, when people are in treatment, they're learning about the vast number, the giant number of other victims that some of these offenders have. I'm looking at a sheet that I got from the prison, 2007, rates, returns within 3 years of release. And for individuals who come back for sex offenses as opposed to other offenses, it's pretty high. I'm looking at 32.9% for one category of paroled individuals coming back for new sex offenses. But obviously, in the community-based treatments that we don't fund well enough, we do what we can with the funds that we have.
And what would you do with more, though? I mean, you know, throw more money at this. How would that improve it?
Well, I think there can be more supervision for those who are on parole. And when you are dealing with them going off the rails in terms of what they're supposed to be doing while they're on parole or probation, we have one thing we can do, lock them up again. You need to be able to say, here's a tier, a spectrum of things that we can have you do as we try and get you back on track. And if we had the ability and the funding to put them, number one, more closely supervised, number two, to have programs and therapy treatment that we can direct them to and help stabilize them again.
Does every sex offender have to go through treatment before he or she is released?
They now evaluate people, and depending on the evaluation, make a determination of what level of treatment they get at the prison, because it is, of course, pretty minimal resources. The other problem that money has posed in terms of the implementation of the Adam Walsh Act is that we did in New Hampshire explore, it's my understanding, doing assessments of people. You know, the Adam Walsh Act didn't say everybody goes in a particular tier. There were certain things we had to do to come in compliance. And some states have looked at assessment. We looked at it. We can't afford to do the assessments. Should we? Yes.
That might be helpful.
But one of the things with Adam Walsh was making sure that states are consistent, because if you aren't consistent, people move to states where the restrictions aren't as great. And, you know, if we're thinking about reducing our restrictions and making New Hampshire the appealing place for sex offenders to move, I'd suggest that would be bad public policy for our state.
Chris, 2 seconds. I can see you want to jump in.
I think it's a myth that people move from state to state. We're talking people who are unemployed, many of them homeless. They're just trying to get through the next day.
Well, I think we have a lot more to talk about. I appreciate both of you coming in and joining us this hour. Not easy. So thanks for tackling it with us, Chris Dornan. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Chris Dornan, founder of Citizens for Criminal Justice Reform. Tom Reed, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Tom Reed, Deputy County Attorney for Rockingham County. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineers, Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Tim Camerato. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Canoy.